This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show with me, T. Xiaoyik. Whenever you visit a clinic, see a doctor, or buy medicines, you're actually coming into contact with the health system. Our health system is what we depend on to ensure that we get the services and care we need to stay healthy. But there's more to it than just hospitals and doctors. We're starting a new series called Health, the Nuts and Bolts, which goes behind the scenes to explore what makes a health system work and what we need to improve on for Malaysia. And in this first episode, we're doing a 101 on health systems. You'll be hearing throughout the series from Dr. Kaur Swee King, Public Policy Specialist. Welcome to the show, Swee King. How are you today?
I'm well today, Sherry. Thanks very much.
I think a quick background on you and your areas of interest and research in health would help us to understand where you'll be coming from when we go through this series. So introduce yourself.
Thank you, Sherry. Well, I'm from Taiping, Para. I will begin there. I went to medical school in UKM, Kebangsaan, Malaysia, and I graduated a few years ago and went back to Taiping and Greek hospitals to serve in the Ministry of Health Malaysia. After 4.5 years of service and getting a specialist paper in internal medicine, I decided that health systems was the way to go because it was an opportunity to serve the population in a much bigger scale. And I thought I wanted to see the world a little bit, and I joined the pharmaceutical industry for 8 years. And during this period, I had the opportunity to also do refugee work and disaster relief work as well. During my time in the pharma industry, I lived and worked in, well, about 90 over countries, frankly, supporting ethics and compliance for various countries in the emerging world, and also clinical research in Singapore. I've been away for 8 years. I've just come back to Malaysia in April this year, and I'm now doing health systems that allows me to see the component parts of a health system from various parts of the world and try to bring those lessons back to Malaysia. So that's a brief intro about me.
So why... did you think it was important to, be on the show to have a series about health systems? What is it about the health systems that you think we could unpack in a series like this?
Well, maybe I can quote what the World Health Organization wants as the aims of a health system, and then we work backwards from there. Mm-hmm. The World Health Organization believes that there are three aims for a health system. The first one is they want good health outcomes, meaning you live longer, you live healthier lives, and so on and so forth. Number two, the World Health Organization also wants the health system to be financially fair. What this means is the poor should not be disadvantaged as a result of healthcare catastrophes. In other words, you should not be bankrupt as a result of receiving healthcare. Mm-hmm. And the third aim from the World Health Organization's principles of health systems is that the health system needs to be responsive. What this means is your lived experience, meaning your day-to-day or even hopefully just once a year experience mm-hmm. of going to a clinic or to a hospital must be a, well, pleasant experience, shall we say. Mm. The waiting times are not too long and so on and so forth. So working backwards with these three aims, right? I think that Malaysia and indeed the rest of the world could understand the nuts and bolts of the health system very much better so that we understand what we need from a health system and then we can politically ask for it.
Okay. But, you know, if I asked you to define a health system so that people could understand what comes under, what are we talking about? As I said earlier, it's not just the hospitals and doctors or even your medications. So what is a health system?
I really like the title of the show, Nuts and Bolts. So maybe I'll bring up the example of a car. So many Malaysians have a car. And if you think of a car and try to draw the analogy to a health system, and then you can unpack it a little bit easier. So a car has an engine, it has a steering wheel, it has brakes, and it's got fuel compartments and so on and so forth. And a health system has 6 components, and we'll run through them one by one, and I'll just give a brief overview. The first component is the workforce. In other words, human capital and the people who work inside the health system. It could be doctors, nurses, paramedics, and so on. The second component of a health system is the delivery component. What this means is hospitals, clinics, mobile clinics, the rural flying services for Sabah and Sarawak, and so on.
So your physical infrastructure of where you'd go to get medical care.
Correct. Okay. It's physical. Sometimes it can also be virtual, especially when we explore the worlds of telemedicine, for example. Mm. But I think physical infrastructure is a great way to talk about it. The third component or building block, which is the official terminology for it, the building block, the third building block is actually the medicines, vaccines, and technologies. So the first three are the people that uses the physical infrastructure to deliver medicines, vaccines, and technologies and services.
Okay.
So this is a good first three steps. Mm-hmm. But underneath all that is the need to pay for it. And that's the fourth building block, which is a financing element.
Mm-hmm.
You also need the fifth element, which is informatics. And you need to know how many beds you have, what is the disease profiles in Malaysia, do we have more diabetes in Perlis, for example, and do we have more tuberculosis in Sarawak, for example. This informatics system or IT system underpins the sixth one, which is leadership and governance. And leadership and governance is from the Minister of Health, including other ministers, all the way down to the physician leaders, nursing leaders, and so on at the operational level as well. And underlying all that, leadership has also the governance component, which ties all the six blocks together in a coherent whole. So there you have it, Shawik, the six blocks.
All right. And about the leadership, because I remember when we were talking about it outside, before we came in, you wanted to make the distinction between health and healthcare. The reason I ask that is because is the Ministry of Health, say in Malaysia, is it the Ministry of Health that will be the sole custodian of our health system? If you say that health is something bigger than just healthcare.
I will answer immediately and emphatically, no. The Ministry of Health is not the only or sole or even the major custodian of health. Okay, maybe they're the major custodian of health in a sense that they receive a whole lot of allocations for them to deliver healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
But having answered that question, hopefully quite emphatically, can I make two more thoughts, share two more thoughts with you? The first one is the difference between health and healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
Healthcare is the delivery of healthcare. For example, hospitals and surgeries and medicines and vaccines and technology, that is healthcare. But if you look at health itself, there are many things that are non-medical, non-surgical, non-hospital, non-doctor that actually promotes health. Let me give a few examples. Poverty eradication is the single biggest health-promoting act that a government can do. When you are rich, generally, you'll consume more health and you'll be healthier. Another health-promoting, non-doctor, non-medicine, non-surgical component of health is education.
Mm-hmm.
A third one is increasing literacy, gender empowerment, better sanitation, rural electrification, and the list goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
So if we only focus on hospitals to deliver healthcare, we're missing out on this huge opportunity to deliver health in a very holistic way.
But would a health system be able to take care of these other non-healthcare components?
Not directly. I guess if you're talking about the health system as in the Ministry of Health, then the Ministry of Health would not be directly responsible for, say, health...
Education or gender.
For example, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, the World Health Organization also promotes a concept that I'd like to introduce to all of us today called health in all policies. What this means in short is that every ministry in Malaysia, and we'll talk about Malaysia for the rest of this show, every ministry in Malaysia will have a health component. The education ministry, for example, trains doctors because that comes under universities, and obviously that has a clear health component.
Mm-hmm.
The Ministry of Defence, for example, you may think has got nothing to do with health,
mm-hmm.
but when they secure the borders, they're also preventing the transmission of communicable diseases, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly they take into account the welfare of all the veterans, former soldiers who've served us, and they retire at age 40 or 42, and they enter our health system as well. And so on and so forth for all the 20-something ministries that we have, maybe 24 or 28 ministries that we have in Malaysia.
So health is something that all portfolios and all sectors need to be looking at.
Very true.
Okay. You talked about WHO's goals for what health systems should serve. It was there should be good health outcomes. It should be financially fair and be responsive. So that's on a big picture level. But when it comes down to the individual person, I guess that's where being responsive comes in as well. But could you help us understand how a health system is meant to serve individual people, whether they're in the healthcare system or in the community.
I'll begin by saying that the health system for Malaysia has to take into account the needs of 32 million Malaysians. Mm-hmm. And often our great bureaucrats and technocrats are in Putrajaya, and they're well-trained and well-equipped, and I have a lot of confidence in them. That number of 32 million often becomes a statistic because it's not the lived reality of our policymakers at every level of government. Mm. So this is just a very neutral statement that I'll begin with. So the lived experience of the individual rakyat who goes to a health system has to fulfill those three needs of World Health Organization. I'll give one example for each of those three aims. Mm-hmm. The first aim is to improve health outcomes directly for the person with diabetes, for example. It is to have good diabetes control, avoiding blindness, avoiding heart attacks, and avoiding amputations of the lower legs. Mm-hmm. And if we can achieve all that, the avoidance and the prevention of the complications of diabetes, we would have achieved the first aim of a health system for the individual rakyat in Malaysia. Mm-hmm. A second example is about financial fairness. And here I might introduce a new term called universal health coverage, and maybe we'll talk about that later. Universal health coverage essentially means you will get the treatment that you need when you need it without going bankrupt. Mm-hmm. Statistics from AKPK, our credit and debt management and counselling agency, shows that between 6 to 20% of Malaysians who go bankrupt because of medical costs. And this is unacceptable today. What I want to highlight is health systems are also social institutions. Mm-hmm. They are institutions that promote solidarity. So if we allow 6 to 20% of Malaysians to go bankrupt as a result of healthcare, then who are we as a country? And can we call ourselves, well, taking care, are we fulfilling a moral duty, so to speak, to take care of the less fortunate? Mm. So the lived experience, you should not go bankrupt as a result of accessing healthcare. This does not mean that you go for the most expensive medicines and the most expensive surgeries, even when you don't need them. Mm. The third lived reality for our individual rakyat as it relates to World Health Organization is responsiveness. What this means is the lived experience of you going to a clinic. So a few micro examples would be you don't wait unnecessary periods. The second lived reality for individual rakyat is that the doctors spend enough time with you to educate you about the disease, and they're doing so in a courteous enough, in a polite enough, and in a warm and friendly and human enough level. Mm. All these micro examples, I guess, are lived realities of the rakyat related to the three aims of World Health Organization.
Where does preventive health come in?
Preventive health comes at every level of the health system. As I unpack the idea of preventive health, maybe it's instructive to put a few numbers on the table. Firstly, I'll begin by saying that curative, as opposed to preventive, is crucial, very important. It's also very expensive. Mm-hmm. So fully 69% of our health budget in Malaysia in 2017, based on the Ministry of Health report from 2017, 69% of it goes towards curative care, and only 7% goes to preventive care. This is understandable, mostly because curative services are so expensive. Medicines, vaccines, surgeries, and so on are very, very expensive. So we'll leave that aside. There is no prescription by any multilateral organization about what's the percentage of the health budget that you should go preventive versus curative. So they don't say you should do 50-50 or 10-90 or anything of that sort. So that's my second thought. The third and final thought I'll share about where preventive services come in is actually at all levels of the health system. And here I introduce the concept of who is in the health system. And it's not only the 270,000 employees in Ministry of Health, it's also 32 million Malaysians. Mm-hmm. We are all inside the health system. Therefore, if I may even encourage those listening in right now, whenever there's a prevention program or health promotion program, there are some recommendations that is probably good for us to follow, in the sense that when we feel healthy and we're asymptomatic, in other words, we don't have any symptoms, we tend not to see a doctor for any screening, and they may not be so wise. So I'll say preventive treatments or preventive approaches should be in all parts of the health system, and this includes all those listening in today, as well as 32 million Malaysians?
Well, easier said than done. Obviously, we know that Malaysians are very resistant to changing their behaviours and habits for their health, but that's a topic for another day, I think. We're talking about health systems today. We're doing a 101, an introduction for a new series called Health, the Nuts and Bolts, which is we're trying to go behind the scenes to explore what makes a health system work, especially here in Malaysia. In the studio with me, Dr. Kaur Swee King, Public Policy Specialist. We'll be right back after this quick break, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back with me, T. Xiao Ik. In the studio with me, Dr. Kaur Swee King, Public Policy Specialist on our series Health, the Nuts and Bolts, which explores what makes a health system work. On our first episode today, we're doing a 101 on health systems. Before the break, Swee King, you briefly mentioned universal health coverage, and this is a term sometimes used interchangeably with universal health care. So what is universal health coverage?
The term universal health coverage can be abbreviated to UHC. And sometimes people think that UHC means universal health care as opposed to coverage, and they're two separate entities. Universal health care means that every citizen will be able to access health care. In other words, we have successfully removed all the barriers to access. And barriers to access are not just physical, as in, is the health facility within 3 kilometers of where you stay? Mm-hmm. It's also cultural, as in some disempowered minorities, for example, women or those who are less educated or those who are poor might not be able to access them. Mm-hmm. It could be emotional, psychological, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So we'll leave that aside to talk about universal health coverage right now. Mm-hmm. What it means is, and I'm going to not use the World Health Organization definition, but to say you will get the care that you need when you need it without going bankrupt.
Mm-hmm. It relates to finances.
It does relate to financial fairness, equity, justice, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But let me use a term that perhaps the more closely mirrors the lived reality of the people listening in and the 32 million Malaysians. The term financial catastrophe and or bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. This is an evolution. Universal health coverage, the term UHC, is a relatively new term. New as in it's come in the last 10 or 20 years. Because if you look back after the Second World War, when health systems began to be built more comprehensively for everyone, in the 40s, 50s and 60s, I mean 1940s, 1950s and 1960s, we were focusing on building hospitals. Well, healthcare was cheap at that time. Paracetamol and simple technologies were the only things available to us at that time. But as health systems began to become more sophisticated, vaccines and medicines and surgeries and MRIs and so on became much more expensive, the financial component comes into play. So previously, it was almost physical access is the problem. Right now, we have to ensure that's financial access. So universal health coverage, to repeat, means that you get the care that you need when you need it without going bankrupt. And it represents an evolution, a moving target, a moving goalpost of sorts for our health systems. Because once we fix this problem, shall we, I assure you, we'll have a new problem to fix.
But you talk about finances, and that is the biggest conversation now with healthcare. And that concerns not only governments, but also every individual. Because when we need to see a doctor, when we need to get treatment for conditions, chronic conditions like cancer, diabetes, foremost on our minds is, can we afford it? It's a strange dichotomy we're in. Advances in medical technologies, in the kinds of treatments to help prolong our lives. At the same time, an increasing burden of disease and skyrocketing costs of healthcare. Does this mean our health system has failed?
That's a difficult question to answer, Shawika, whether or not the health system has failed. And if I centre it to the Malaysian health system, no, it hasn't failed. I think our population health still achieves very good outcomes for, well, frankly, a fraction of the spending that we see other countries are investing in health. So at least in that particular metric, our health system has not failed. However, all the problems that you mentioned are extremely real. And there is a possibility that our health system, as in Malaysia's health system, could fail, however you define failure. And frankly, there could be pockets in our health system where it indeed has already failed. As with many things in life, or all things in life, the truth is probably somewhere in the in between.
Mm-hmm. So coming back to just looking at a health system generally, then what are the factors that contribute to a healthy working health system?
The technical jargon for it is performance measurement of the health system. And generally speaking, performance measurements means that you are tracking key performance indicators or KPIs. So let me give a couple of examples. For those listening in, if you're working in a private sector company, you might be given a target, a sales target, for example, or to finish a project before a particular deadline. And these are the examples of metrics that might be put in for the health system as well. For those who maybe even have children, you will set targets for your children. For example, you must get a minimum of 7 A's in SPM before I will buy you that new iPhone, for example. So there are incentives and demand and supply and many economics factors that comes into the concept of performance management of a health system. Mm-hmm. The second thought I'll share about performance measurements is that it has two main aims. The first one is to ensure outcomes, meaning you are getting good outcomes for the money that you're investing in. Mm-hmm. Number two is to ensure that you're spending the money very responsibly, because health is really a black hole. It's limitless. You can never spend too much on health.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's such a black hole, we must be careful that we measure the inputs and outputs. Those are economics terms, and, well, get the best value for our money. An example, if I may finally end, an example of a performance measurement is, how long does it take for a patient to see a doctor in the accidents and emergency department if the patient is a red case? Red case in the sense that the most emergent. And that's a good metric for us to measure the performance of a health system. Another performance measurement is how quickly in the calendar year do we finish the budget that is allocated to us? So, for example, some hospitals could finish their budgets in September, and that could mean pretty good management or poor management, depending on how you see it. And some hospitals might not finish their budgets until February of the following year, for example. And that might mean under-treatment or over-treatment. So the statistics in themselves are helpful, but they're not totally giving you the whole picture. So you must also look at the context.
Who sets these measures?
There are two groups of people, main groups of people who sets these measures, shall we? The first group of people is the healthcare technocrats, shall we say. And they have many guidance documents and prescriptions and so on and so forth by organizations like the World Health Organization, Institute for Health Measurement and Effectiveness, various NGOs and think tanks and people in academia.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the people at the technocratic and bureaucratic level. And I think they were well-staffed in Malaysia. And I think there are many wonderful technocrats in the Ministry of Health who set these targets. The second group of people who set these targets are the politicians. And I say politicians because ultimately health systems are also a political, economic, social and cultural system. And we can talk about that a little bit more later. Let's talk about the political element as opposed to the bureaucratic element. The technocrat bureaucrat will propose a list of, let me invent a number, 50 health metrics.
Mm-hmm.
But the politician, in response to the implicit or explicit social contract provided to them by the electorate, renewed every 5 years, will then decide what metrics they want to look at. So these are the two groups of people, and there's a good communication between the political masters and also the bureaucrat and technocrat in determining performance metrics.
You say good communication. I potentially see conflict. Would there be?
There will be inevitably conflict. Let me center my next comments about the Malaysian health system. The Ministry of Health technocracy runs very well. And I will make the next comment to say that despite the changes in various health ministers over the years from Barisan Nasional and also Pakatan Harapan, each of the health ministers have got their own personality styles, their own experience, including lived experience, including their expertise in or outside of the health system. And yet that kind of relationship still seems to, on one end of the spectrum, work perfectly well. On the other end of the spectrum, seem to muddle along.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in that particular sense, there seems to be a working relationship. Could it be better? Of course. But I think the tensions between the political realities and the politicians and the technocrats and bureaucrats in any country, including in America, the OECD or in Europe or in Japan, will always be there and therefore necessarily will always be an imperfect relationship, shall we say.
Mm.
But a necessary one for democracy to function.
Right, right. And so that pretty much describes how you see the health system as a political, economic, social, cultural system as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll begin with the political element. And we talked earlier about the health system only almost promoting health,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Giving healthcare to the poor, the indigent, the people in rural communities, Borneo, and so on and so forth. And that is very true. But there are four other components to a health system that I think is very interesting. The first one is that a health system is also a political system. It defines a social contract.
Mm-hmm.
In terms, for example, the lived reality might sound like this. For X percent of my taxes or Y ringgit of my taxes, I will get Z services.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a political contract, a social contract of sorts that's renewed every 5 years. A health system is also an economic system. And here's it's economic in a few ways. The first one is we obviously have the private sector in Malaysia, private hospitals, Khazanah owns hospitals, there is a Sunway Group and so on. We have general practitioner clinics who are solo practitioners and they're working in the private space. So the health system is a buy-sell marketplace
mm-hmm.
where the doctors are selling their services, for example, and hospitals are selling a room charge, for example, and people are buying it from them. It also therefore defines the economic relationship between the private system as well as the public system. And how does the public system fund preventive healthcare services, for example, because mm-hmm. inevitably the private system does not fund preventive, they only fund curative, and the taxation that goes in and out and the tax breaks and the various healthcare tourism efforts that we are promoting. So it's also an economic institution. Can I go on to talk to you about how it's a social institution?
Yes.
And let me introduce the term solidarity over here. Mm. Solidarity between rich and poor. Solidarity between old and young. Solidarity between urban and rural. We have only 32 million Malaysians. And I say only because so many more countries are more populous than us. And I think mm-hmm. Malaysia is the 46th or 45th most populous country in the world. And even at 46th most populous country in the world, we already have, say, challenges with solidarity. And this is a chicken and egg situation. Young, old, rich, poor, urban, rural is a chicken and egg. So do you get solidarity first before you get a good health system? Or do you get a good health system to promote solidarity?
Mm.
And that's an interesting thought too. Finally, I end with the thought of a health system being a cultural institution. We talk about the human experience of giving birth and aging and disease and impairment and death. And these are lived realities of all 32 million Malaysians. And if we have a good experience when your wife or you indeed have given birth and you have, as least bad as possible, an experience as your father lays dying in a hospital bed, then it also informs the way you think about life itself.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, health systems are also cultural institutions.
We're talking about health systems today with Dr. Kaw Swee King, public policy specialist. We'll go for a quick break now, and when we come back, it'll be interesting to have a bit of a historical look at how Malaysia's health system has evolved. We'll be right back, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to the show with me, T. Xiao Ik. In the studio with me, Dr. Kaw Swee King, public policy specialist, and this is our series called The Health. This is our series called Health, the Nuts and Bolts. We're looking at health systems, trying to understand what makes a health system work and how do we improve on it. As I mentioned before, the break, Swee King, could you give us a bit of a history lesson on the health system in Malaysia?
Well, to talk about the history of the health system in Malaysia, and caveat, I am not a historian. I don't have all the facts in front of me, but maybe I can tell a story. And we'll begin the story in 1957. A few words about what happened before 1957 is that healthcare was generally provided by the British, for the British, for the British people who were here at that time. And there were some community hospitals that were funded and run by
missionaries for the general population, meaning the local population, local Malaysians, Malayans at that time, and also funded by the Chinese community. Indeed, the first general hospital in Malaysia is from my hometown in Taiping. I think it was built in 1874 or 76 or something of that sort, funded completely by the Chinese community, also with a tax, if I can use the word tax, of I think it was £1 or something like that by every inhabitant in that particular township at that time.
So every resident paid a tax, and that means you get to access service at the hospital. Oh, interesting.
Of course, records are very patchy, and we have some oral history rather than written records. And healthcare before 1957 was also dominated by, say, traditional, what we call today traditional and complementary medicine. And indeed, the Malay archipelago is home to the, these days we call them the Bomos, the Pawangs, the Dusuns, and these are the people who also provided healthcare to the community of Malaya at that time. But let's go into 1957, and we'll go back into history a little bit. Maybe we can divide that into three time periods. Malaysia's about 60 years old right now, so let's say the first 20 years, the second 20 years, and the final 20 years. So the first 20 years will be from 57 to 77 thereabouts, and the second one will be from 77 to 97 thereabouts, and then 1997 to 2019 or thereabouts. I will begin by saying that in the 1960s to the 80s, in period number one, we had a very rudimentary health system. If I recall the number, today we have something like 57,000 doctors in Malaysia. But at that time, we had 854 doctors serving a population of 8 million at that time. So we had very few doctors, almost no nurses, and almost no paramedics, for example. The diseases were largely communicable. Some of them I've never even seen. For example, leprosy, yaws, malaria. Well, I've seen malaria and we still have tuberculosis today. But the incidence of these diseases are so much lower. Maternal death is also very high, meaning mothers would die during childbirth or in the first 1 month after delivery. Babies would die at shocking numbers, really, before the first year or even the fifth year of life. The hospitals that we had were generally in the private setting rather than the public setting. This was what it was like in the period of 57 to 77. But Tunku Abdul Rahman and Tun Abdul Razak, respectively the fathers of independence and development of Malaysia, went out into the rural areas. And we built many, many facilities, and we trained many, many nurses and paramedics and medical assistants. And then we, well, wrested back control over diseases. So in the second period, we saw the rapid growth of a lot of rural health facilities. Number one, the training of a large workforce. Number two, and number three, a change in adding on, well, back then the emphasis was on primary care, and then we added on secondary and tertiary care. And then you see now the outlines of today's health system. As a result of that massive amounts of development, human capital and physical infrastructure, and adding secondary and tertiary care, the disease profile changed. Fewer and fewer maternal and child deaths, fewer and fewer communicable disease deaths, and our health outcomes improved. A note, Shawik, at that time, healthcare was still generally quite well funded. Or rather, people didn't go bankrupt as a result of it. They could access the public healthcare system quite well. Healthcare itself was quite cheap. Medicines were cheap. We didn't have expensive technologies at that time. We could spend something like 2 to 6% of our federal government budget on health. And well, last year it was 9.1%, just for us to anchor the conversation. Let's move on to the third period. In the third period, it's probably characterized by the entry or even the strengthening of the private system. Ever since Tun Dr. Mahathir came into power around 1981, it was a time of Reaganomics and Thatcherite economics. There was this wholesale privatization element to many aspects of our economy. Tenaga, Petronas, and so on and so forth were privatized. Healthcare began to be privatized as well. Well, of course, we still maintain this huge public system, and I think that's crucial to deliver healthcare equitably and efficiently. The private sector began growing with a few private hospitals that were doctor-owned in the beginning. and moving on to private hospitals that were private capital owned, moving on to private hospital chains that were private capital owned and owned by conglomerates as well. And healthcare technologies, surgeries, investigations and so on became more and more expensive. Our population health grew in tandem with the health expenditures and so on and so forth too. And there you have it, the third phase, so to speak, and the disease profile completely changed too as a result of this investment in the increasing technology. We lived a lot longer. Mm-hmm. Previously, it was average life expectancy of 59 around 1960 for both male and females. And right now, male and females live to about 75 years old. So we gained about 16 years of life in only a 60-year period fueled by all this. And now we've got different problems of non-communicable diseases and we may have aging coming up. What you said earlier, yeah, problems abound. But I guess this is almost a checkpoint process for our health system. It evolves to such an extent that the more problems you fix, you'll get newer problems. And I think it's fun to fix these newer problems.
But are we just playing catch up? Are we seeing the challenges ahead? Are we only putting out fires?
The health system will forever play catch up to our mortality in the sense that we're all mortal and at some point death will happen inevitably to all of us. And how much you want to rail against the dying of the light is a personal choice, religious choice, cultural choice, which goes back to the cultural institution that is the health system. But we'll leave that aside to say, are we playing catch up in the sense that technologies go more and more expensive? This is true. And will we be able to financially afford them? We can. There are some thoughts that I might be able to share shortly, but it requires a new political and social contract between ourselves. Mm-hmm. We need to be more mindful of our own responsibility to our own body. So while it's possible that we will face headwinds forever, we can still make good choices today that can bring our health system forward for the next 20 to 30 years.
But has our health system actually regressed in a sense? We have lost our focus on primary care, for instance, increasing private ownership of healthcare services. Have we regressed in the way we can deliver good health outcomes as a principle?
Well, it depends on what you mean by regressed, Shawik.
I'm very pessimistic.
I am neither optimistic nor pessimistic, just realistic about the world. And sorry to become a bit pedantic about this. It really depends on how you define the word regressed. And if you define it one way, yes, we have regressed. And if you define it in another way, then we have not regressed. But let me talk about the two themes that you brought up, primary care and private sector healthcare. In primary care, it is true, we have lost our focus on primary care. Can I share a fun story with you?
Sure.
In 1978, the Soviet Socialist Republic of Kazakhstan, in Alma-Ata, the World Health Organization convened this group, I think it was the World Health Assembly at that time, and they signed a declaration in 1978 saying that primary care will take us there. That was 1978 in the Soviet Socialist Republic of Kazakhstan. Mm-hmm. In 2018, fast forward 30 years later, and this happened only last year, the country has changed. Instead of SSR Kazakhstan, I think it's now the Democratic Socialist Republic of Kazakhstan or something like that. Mm. The capital city has changed, Alma-Ata, to Astana, and they signed a new declaration reaffirming the World Health Organization's commitment to primary care. Mm. And in that declaration of Astana in 2018, 1 year ago, they admitted failure, that the whole world has failed in primary care. The system that we built post-1945 got us to good health outcomes for, well, I would say, let me invent a number, I don't have the statistic, but 80% of the world. I'm talking about the billion people in Africa, the billion people in China, and so on and so forth. It did get us there. But we've been seduced by the concept of quick cures, and new is better, expensive is best, and private is better, and secondary, tertiary hospitals are better. When primary care is still de-proven by a million studies to be the best, most effective and most cost-effective way to deliver better health outcomes. So we have regressed in that particular sense. But I think the rhetoric is definitely for primary care. We just have to match the reality to the rhetoric. Mm. I think private healthcare is an unavoidable feature of Malaysia's health landscape. To nationalize the private healthcare space and to bring everything back, a reverse privatization, for example, and bring everything back into the Ministry of Health, is probably probably not feasible for various reasons, which are probably obvious to all of us. Then the question becomes, how can we moderate the private sector in two ways? The first one is to moderate it in the form of integration with our public system. So with public and private integration, and we can explore integration perhaps in other sessions, how can we get a good system where the public and private are perhaps even in healthy competition with one another, certainly complementary and not having unnecessary conflict.
Mm.
The second way we can moderate the private sector is to have a good social debate, a good public debate about the role of the private sector in healthcare. I mean, an uncomfortable question is, should we really profit from healthcare? And I can see both sides of the situation, and perhaps we don't have time to discuss that right now. It's an interesting and endless debate. But let me give the example of Japan. Japan, all hospitals, and all is a strong word, all hospitals are privately owned. But all hospitals are non-profit.
Mm.
And they're non-profit, privately owned. And you could have a third space, in a sense, between the and I'm talking about the political economy. I'm not talking about health system anymore. I'm talking about the whole world. I'm not talking about Malaysia anymore. Maybe our global economy needs a third space. It doesn't have to be purely public and philanthropic and aid-giving, grant-giving and this bottomless black hole.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, neither does it have to be pure profit-making. There could be a third space, social enterprises, B corporations. The new political economy of the world is currently being shaped. And I think healthcare could lead that through civil society organizations and non-governmental organizations. Profit could be reinvested. We have social impact bonds and so on and so forth. All this new ways of organizing our political economy globally, not just in Malaysia, will have implication on health systems globally, not just in Malaysia as well.
There's a lot more to unpack when it comes to the Malaysian health system as well. When I asked about have we regressed, I was just picking on two things that immediately come to mind. But we will, in the course of this series, look at each of the main building blocks that you've explained and where it is that we could strengthen, what are the gaps, and so on. But I'd like you to look into your crystal ball, Suiking. What do you envision our health system to be? What should it be in the next, shall we say, 20 to 30 years? Or how far do you think we should project?
Can I give, say, maybe a 3 or 4 year projection and then a 20, 30 year projection? So I'll give two. Let's talk about the next 4 years. And I say 4 years because that's the time period that Pakatan Harapan has to fulfill the promises that they've made in their election manifesto, the Buku Harapan. And then we'll talk about 2050, for example, which is a 30 year period and it's going to come to us very quickly.
Yes.
So in the next 4 years, and one huge factor for Pakatan Harapan is to fulfill the promise of 4% of GDP public spending on health. Today, we're spending 4.5% of GDP on health. And half of that comes from public spending, half of that comes from private spending. Well, the correct number is actually 51-49, but let's just simplify and say 50-50. So to get to 4% of public funding for health, Pakatan will have to double the health ministry budget. And this is a mathematically very difficult thing to do without increasing the tax base and doubling the tax or taking money away from education, security services and devoting it to health. I have thoughts about how we can have a predictable allocation mechanism. Flat 10% year on year, depending on the tax take for Malaysia. So year on year, we'll get 10% and that locks in the allocation. 10 is an arbitrarily chosen number. I can back it up with a reasonable case. But we can't go 30 or 40% for health because how are we going to spend on schools and infrastructure and electrification and so on and so forth. So I think the major challenge for Pakatan is to come up with a mechanism for them to get to 4% of GDP of public spending. So one way is a predictable mechanism, the funding and allocation mechanism. The second way is to begin some experiments or enhance their currently ongoing experiments in social health insurance. I understand there's a debate on both sides of the divide about the applicability, the good or bad of social health insurance. But many countries have social health insurance, especially in the OECD. And while it hasn't been perfect, no system will ever be perfect, we can learn the lessons from them. So that could be a second example about how we can increase to 4% of GDP. By mobilizing new sources of financing. The third way that we can meet or Pakatan Harapan government can meet the 4% of GDP commitment is to explore non-insurance sources of financing. And here I think it's a subject for a separate conversation. We'll need bonds, private capital, good public-private partnerships that ensures that public and private shares the risk as well as the reward. Generally speaking, governments around the world, not just in Malaysia, send poor negotiators to the negotiation table with private sectors simply because we're not trained in purchasing. So that's the three thoughts that I have about where we should go to meet the 4% of GDP commitment. And obviously, this comes with the assumption that increasing spending is a good in and of itself. I don't think so, because you can increase spending and throw it into a limitless black hole if you don't reform the organization of the health system in Malaysia. More money is only part of the solution. Where we should go in the next 30 years is to solve strategically solve the problems of today and prepare for the problems of tomorrow. What I mean to say is, if we find new sources of financing and we fix that problem, and number two, we reform the health system, including the way we deliver and pay for healthcare. Thirdly, we re-emphasize primary care. Fourthly, we fix the NCD problem. If you fix all these problems, and I think we have a good chance of fixing these problems as we go along the show. Maybe there'll be specific prescriptions. Let's say we'll take 10 years to fix the problem. So we'll fix it in 2030. People will start living longer. From 75 years old, average life expectancy in Malaysia, we're going to live till 95. And can you imagine a 95-year-old person in Malaysia? And that is the crisis of the future. Well, maybe the word crisis is a bit strong, but it's a slow-moving crisis of the future. You fix today's problems, you'll have a whole new set of problems. And let me list them. Solutions can come perhaps at the next session. But the problems would be a long lifespan. Health system-wise, you have to find a way to, well, treat their cancers and other non-communicable diseases. You have to, health system-wise, treat their loneliness and dementia. Health system-wise, find a way to replace their failing organs. If our society decides that we want to live as long as we can and not, and we don't have the discussion about death with dignity, another separate rabbit hole conversation. And assuming we want to rail against the dying of the light and we want to live as long as we can, then underlying all that, we have to find a way to pay for it. And underlying all that is the way our economy and our politics and our society, our pension systems needs to be completely reformed for us to get there. By way of example, our retirement age is 60 at the moment. You can't have a 35-year-old retirement. EPFs won't be able. EPF and SOXO will not be able to support you. Also, the government pensions bill will skyrocket, leaving no money for any government service. That's my shoot for the future, for the next 30 years. Fix today's problems in the next 10 years, always keeping an eye on the slow-burning crisis of the future.
I think you are an optimist, Wee-King, because you seem to think we can fix all these problems in the next 10 years. And so we will continue this series to look at some possible solutions where we should be aiming to fix those problems. Thank you very much, Wee-King. You've been listening to Health, the Nuts and Bolts, and this was our very first episode, a 101 on health systems with Dr. Kors Wee-King, public policy specialist. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.